Welcome to the Sufi Reverberations podcast, where each week, God willing, you will be able to hear a poem, a story, a meditation, and a musical interlude that give expression to one Sufi's perspective concerning the mystical dimension of Islam. My name is Anab Whitehouse, and I will be your host. Although I am not a sheikh, nonetheless, I did have the opportunity to spend 16 years in the company of a Sufi saint of the 20th century, and by the grace of God, was able to gain a few insights into the nature of the Sufi mystical path through that association. So, without further delay, let's proceed to the essential contents of this episode. The following flowery selection is entitled Medina. It commemorates my first visit to Medina some 44 years ago, by the grace of Allah. O city of love, of grace, of life, one comes to your doors in search of hope, in search of a path that leads beyond the bonds of darkness which veil one's sight, and into a realm where all is light. Shining faces, eyes of peace, lovely voices, hearts that weep, childlike wonder, souls that seek comfort at the Prophet's feet. O city of heart, of joy, of tears, drown us in the mercy of your depths. Sweep us away beneath your great tide of truth, of kindness, of purity, which turn us from sin and sets us free. Gentle faces, eyes of love, prayerful voices, hearts that know, lives of beauty, souls that go to him through whom mercy flows. City of Ahmed, prophet of God, mother of pearl in a sea of sand, beckoning star in a pitch black night, soothing wind through the pain of our soul, help us all to seek the one true goal. Joyful faces, eyes of depth, awe-filled voices, hearts that long, sleepless bodies, souls with song, praying at the Prophet's mosque. This week's edition of the short story is entitled Absence. There was a theological scholar who was reviewing the course of his life. He remembered the many difficulties he had to endure in order to acquire his knowledge, as well as the considerable dedication and sacrifices that had been required from him in order to arrive at his current position in life. He had been gifted with a near photographic memory, and through persistence and much struggle, he had been able to learn all of the Holy Scriptures together with the entire corpus of sayings uttered by the great prophets and saints of his tradition. He was known far and wide for his encyclopedic command of the vast literature to which the religious tradition to which he belonged gave expression. As he reminisced about his career, he felt a familiar sadness creep into his consciousness. This sadness had haunted him for much of his life, and it seemed to revolve about the fact that although he was a very accomplished scholar, nevertheless there seemed to be something which was missing in his understanding, something he could never quite identify despite having spent many nights thinking about the issue. Although he was semi-retired, he still gave a number of classes at the local university. These courses were always filled with individuals wishing to both learn from him, as well as to be able to say that, once upon a time,
They had studied with a scholarly legend, and thereby had been made living contact with a well-known aspect of modern history within the region. In one of the courses, there was a group of students whom the scholar did not exactly appreciate because they seemed to be constantly searching for some flaw in his knowledge. Fortunately, the scholar always had been able to produce quotes, sources, and evidence to silence them, but each time he entered the room for the problematic class, or at least a class with the problematic individuals, he experienced a certain amount of trepidation, not knowing quite what to expect. Today was the time for that class to meet again. After he had delivered his lecture for the day, he opened the session up to questions. Nervously, he eyed the side of the room where his problematic students usually sat, but they were all quiet, at least for the moment. On the other side of the room, a young lady raised her hand, and the professor pointed in her direction, thereby inviting a question from her. The woman said, "I am just auditing this course on behalf of the administration, but I have found your presentation to be well prepared, and if I may, I would like to follow up on one of the things which you discussed." Professor smiled and nodded his head in a way which conveyed both a sense of acknowledgment concerning her prefatory remarks, as well as an assent to her request. He waited for her to continue. The young woman began. "In your lecture, you talked about a tradition which described an encounter between God and a human being, who, if I remember correctly, was being chastised by divinity because the individual had failed to visit God when God was ill, or feed God when God was hungry, or quench the thirst of God when God was thirsty. You went on to explain that the person being chastised had wondered how it was possible for God, who that person considered perfect and beyond all needs, to be ill, hungry, or thirsty. You further informed us that the individual, in response to his wondering, was informed by divinity that God had been with a certain man who was sick, and the person being chastised had not visited that ill man. And in addition, there had been a woman who had been hungry, and a child who had been thirsty, both of whom God had been with, and yet the individual being chastised had not fed the woman nor quenched the thirst of the child. Is my understanding of things correct so far?" asked the woman. The scholar nodded his head in the affirmative, adding, "And your question? Do you agree with the implication of the story you have told? That is, do you attempt to implement its underlying moral principle, and therefore try to be with those who are sick, or feed someone who is hungry, or quench the thirst of someone who may be thirsty? Not only because these are good things to do, but because you know that God is present with such people, and God is witness to what we do or don't do in these respects." Despite being put off somewhat by the challenging nature, if not sheer effrontery, of her query, nevertheless the professor gathered his composure. While he was thinking of what to say, the thought crossed his mind that, possibly, the troublemakers in his course had been fomenting dissension outside the classroom, and for whatever reason, the administration had decided to investigate. Sensing there was more to the question than appeared on the surface, and uncertain about whom or what was behind the current situation, he tried to give a measured answer. "Well, young lady, naturally, no human being can be with everyone all the time, and there are limits to what can be expected of any individual. Nonetheless, I do try to help out the needy, and therefore the answer to your question is, yes, I have visited the sick, and I have fed the hungry, and I have given water to the thirsty, although I am sure there is probably much more that I could have and should have done in order to help people out." As soon as the professor had finished, the woman responded, "Whatever else you may have done, I believe there is someone quite close to you who is ill, hungry, and sick, but you ignored that individual." A wave of shock went through the classroom. People seemed to be divided over whether the woman's comments were rude and uncalled for, or whether they were about to hear revelations of something akin to spousal and/or child abuse. There were others who thought the whole situation rather amusing. However, the professor and the young woman were not among the latter group. The scholar was nonplussed by the turn of events. He didn't quite know how to reply to the woman. The woman turned to the rest of the class and said, "The professor is not the only one who has failed in this regard. Many of the rest of you also are guilty of the same thing." Now that the fitting of the shoe had turned away from the professor, some of the titters had changed to murmurs of indignation. Angry remarks arose from various sections of the classroom, especially from among those who often liked to give the professor a hard time. The professor appealed for quiet. When things had calmed down somewhat, he turned to the woman and said, "Perhaps you would care to explain yourself." The woman wasted little time in taking advantage of the opportunity afforded her and remarked, "Professor, you are a very knowledgeable and kind man. You have indeed visited many who were sick, as well as fed those who were hungry, or quenched the thirst of the thirsty. But I still maintain there is someone whom you have missed in this regard." The professor, who had a photographic memory, racked his brain trying to identify the individual whom he might have failed. Try as he might, and without wishing to presume he was perfect in such matters, the fact of the matter was that no one came to mind, and finally he shrugged his shoulders, looking to the woman for some sort of answer and yet fearing what she might say. The woman empathized with the look on the face of the professor and said, "For years, your soul has been ill, and although God has been with your soul night and day, nevertheless, you have not visited God there. For years you have been hungering for the divine presence, but you have not taken the time to feed yourself spiritually. Rather, you were preoccupied with the information contained in books, and for years you have been thirsting for knowledge concerning the reality of divine unity, but you have not taken steps to quench your thirst. Rather, you were content to merely read about the oasis in the desert." When one comes face to face with the truth, what can one do? One is grateful for the understanding, and one tries to think about what to do with such knowledge. So the professor thanked the woman, ended the class, and began thinking about possibilities on the way back home. The title to this week's musical interlude is Common Ground. The past is just a memory, and the future is but a possibility. How imperceptibly the present fades into what will never be again, as it becomes immersed in the mists of not yet realized possibilities. You are listening to the transitory, fleeting, perishable, fragment-filled remnants of the Sufi Reverberations podcast. At the suggestion of one of the listeners for the Sufi Reverberations podcast, I have begun to post the program as a YouTube video. The first two videos have been uploaded, and it will probably take me a while to get up to speed with current editions of the podcast. But for those people who might find it easier to access the podcast through YouTube, now all they have to do is type in Sufi Reverberations, that is S-U-F-I, space, Reverberations, R-E-V-E-R-B-E-R-A-T-I-O-N-S, into the search box at the top of the YouTube page, and they should be taken to whatever videos are currently available through my channel. God loves beauty, and consequently I have added some visual beauty, or tried to each of the YouTube postings. Today's meditative essay is called Evil. From the perspective of practitioners of the Sufi path, how might one characterize evil? Evil takes flight on the wings of intention. Evil is an artificial environment designed and built by human beings. Evil is an illusion created by the absence of perspective. Evil is relative, but in a very absolute sort of way. Evil exploits and is itself exploited. Evil is a color lent to events by human beings while we serve as loci of manifestation to which those events are given expression. Evil is a value-added tax levied by humans against all of creation. Evil is evidence that the exercise of choice is not an idle philosophical exercise. Evil is a force of opposition necessary for spiritual development. For thousands of years, the problem of evil has been perched on the tree of life like a vulture. Human beings have been searching for an answer to why the problem exists at all. Oddly enough, this problem makes more sense in an inexplicable kind of way if one were to suppose there is no God. Under these circumstances, although the consequences of evil are, well, just as evil, one could accept it as merely the downside to the chance events through which our existence supposedly has come into being. From this point of view, evil is a bit of bad luck in the way the dice of physics, chemistry, and biology rolled. The problem of evil becomes more dicey when God is present. Indeed, one of the arguments used by some atheists and agnostics is based on a syllogism involving the implications of evil for the existence of God. This argument goes something as follows. 1. A loving God would not permit evil to exist. 2. Evil exists. 3. Therefore, either A. God does not exist, or B. God exists but is not loving. 4. If B is the case, then God is not worthy of our worship. There are a number of assumptions in the foregoing argument which are not necessarily true, but which are being treated as a priori truths. The first premise assumes we know what being a loving God involves. This premise also presumes to know what a loving God would and would not permit. The second premise assumes everyone is agreed on what constitutes evil. In addition, this premise presupposes that to whatever extent evil exists, God must be held accountable for its existence. Moreover, the second premise assumes everyone is agreed on the precise structural character to which evil gives expression. Is the existence of evil absolute? Is its existence limited? Is the existence of evil relative in some sense, and if so, in what sense is it relative? The foregoing argument also tends to be reductionistic in character. It presupposes the only quality of divinity is love. Qualities such as, to name but a few, justice, transcendence, subtlety, independence, purpose, and order are not considered. No discussion takes place about how such qualities might play off against or cooperate with the quality of love, or with what ramifications. Sufi masters indicate God has made clear on many occasions and in many circumstances that God does no injustice to humanity or any aspect of creation. Human beings, however, love to prejudge situations before all the facts are in. We have a predilection for making judgments and decisions out of presumption, assumption, and ignorance. Human beings tend to be both repelled and attracted by the thought we should have no capacity for free will. We are repelled because the absence of free will seems to throw into question our integrity, identity, and ultimate worth in the scheme of things. We are attracted to the possibility all our actions are determined, because this would seem to give us carte blanche, so to speak, to quote-unquote permit the ego to do its thing while we bear passive witness with a sense of horrified glee. We don't have to assume responsibility for the tab we run up in life. We demand from God the right to choice. We are given choice. Time and time again we are warned by God in explicit detail, both through sacred texts and through spiritually inspired personalities, about the dangers surrounding the responsibility of choice. We are informed about the purpose and function of choice. The parameters of possible consequences of choice are spelled out. We are heedless of those warnings and directives. We exercise said choice. Some of our choices are corrupted by the intentions which underwrite those choices. As a result, we introduce various shapes and forms of evil into the world. We condemn God for the state of pollution generated by our repeated dumping of toxic intentions into the environment. We hold God to be criminally negligent for granting us choice in the first place. We've got God right where we want, on the horns of a moral dilemma. God is wrong not to give us freedom of choice. God is wrong for giving us freedom of choice. Such are the delights and sophistries of the ego when it starts working the angles. We want things both ways. We want choice when this state of affairs serves our purposes. We do not want responsibility when this does not serve our purposes. We want God to be the one we can finger to take the fall when the going gets tough. How clever we humans are. Did God know human beings would misuse the freedom given to them? Sufi masters say yes. However, just as farmers can make use of manure to grow plants, so God knows the secret of using evil to grow spirituality. Something of the nature of this secret has been disclosed to practitioners of the Sufi way. Evil plays its game. Evil does not understand the game it plays is merely a game within a larger game. Unlike the game of evil, the larger game does not exist for either sport or for amusement. Unlike the game of evil, the larger game is not a matter of whim or arbitrariness. There is a seriousness of purpose in the larger game, which is absent from the intention with which evil plays its game. Evil does not understand it can do nothing other than serve the purposes of the larger game, irrespective of its intentions to do otherwise. Evil is not absolute, it is limited, relative, and constrained within certain limits of possibility. Whoever and whatever is unjustly touched by evil receives compensation from God. Sometimes the compensation is given in this life, sometimes it is given in the next life, sometimes it is given in both worlds. God is not niggardly. The compensations and consolations which come from God are most generous and satisfying. Evil is an artificial environment designed and built by human beings. Our egos are the architects of and contractors for this project. Our egos are under the illusion these monuments will last forever. They will not. As history has clearly shown, all the monuments created by human beings have perished or are perishing. This trend will not change in the future. Evil is relative in an absolute way. Evil does generate misery, pain, devastation, and ugliness everywhere it manifests itself. The doing of evil has real consequences for both the victims and perpetrators of evil. These realities cannot be denied. However, the manifestation of evil exists as a transitory phenomenon which is restricted to this world. Furthermore, within this world, its realities also are circumscribed in very determinate ways. Evil is relative to the absolute parameters set for it by divinity. By struggling with evil, ours and that of others, we have the opportunity for spiritual development. Evil generates the conflict, turmoil, tension, antagonism, and opposition that set the stage on which the story of spirituality unfolds. To set the stage in this way, to provide the necessary backdrop of tension against which the storyline takes place, to provide the themes with which spirituality must struggle, is the function which evil serves. These are fundamental components in all good drama. You have been listening to the Sufi Reverberations podcast. I hope you will join me next week for a new episode of this program. May peace be your companion.